166 Barry's 166 of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. I am your host, Jeff Bowdrin. They call me the Booker. More details about that later in the broadcast. With me, my co-host, the Ambler Rambler, Barry Rose, Lord Barents. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good, Jeff. So we're 34 episodes away from our big 200th episode. 34 episodes. When would that be? That's somewhere like, is that April? May?
Somewhere? Oh, geez. You're asking me to do math. I was told there'd be math. Yes. Yeah. And but I'm sure there will be a celebration, a hoedown, pay raises for myself, for you, and for Sweet Lou from the Arcadian Network. I look forward to that, as well as, you know, I'm guessing that might be the episode where we get the either Stone Cold or the Hulkster to come on and be our guest and discuss their careers. Don't hold your breath on that. So, but also episode 200, that might be. Barry, how about episode 200? We consider bringing back those that have been excommunicated from the brothership. Maybe. Who knows? Yeah. Or maybe we'll, you know, here's an idea, Barry. I was actually reached out to by the esteemed Chris Zaha, wanting to know if, in fact, I was shooting on him when I said that he was lacking talent. And I said, of course not, just merely a rib. So maybe on episode 200, we have a reunion of Onset performing live here on Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin Barry. What do you think?
What?
See, now, right now, Zaha, he just got wood right there. You know, he's like, are you here, honey? No, I'm going upstairs. I'm going to get the cold cream. But so on this broadcast, besides Chris Zaha's hard-on, we're going to be talking about the life and legacy of the legendary Pat Patterson, who we, as the day of this recording, we lost today. And we're going to be talking about some fond memories of Pat Patterson. We're looking at a match from 1979 inside a steel cage in Madison Square Garden as Pat takes on the venerable WWF. Was it three W's at this point in 79, Bear?
I think it was still three, yes.
Okay, so the WWF champion, Bob Backlund from Princeton, Minnesota. They will be going after one another in the blow-off match in their series. And besides all that, what else are we going to be talking about, Barry? Oh, we're going to have an interview with our friend Bertrand Hébert, the man who wrote Pat's biography or autobiography, Accepted, which I've mentioned before on this broadcast. Stellar, stellar work. One of my favorite wrestling biographies or autobiographies of all time. Barry, would you agree with that?
Yeah, Jeff, did you get the book at the Fan Fest or did you get it ahead of time?
I think I bought it ahead of time.
Did you get it autographed at the Fan Fest?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. Honestly, I don't remember. It's just up there on my bookcase in the old marital bedroom. I'll have to check to see tonight. But so we're going to be talking about that, a few and sundry other details. And I'm sure the folks will love talking about the life and legacy of Pat Patterson. So, Barry, right now, why don't we take a look at one of the great matches in Pat's career, his tilt against Bob Backlund in the Garden. Okay, Barry, it is time for us now to go to our match of the week. We are talking September 24th, 1979, the hallowed halls of Madison Square Garden inside a steel cage as the late legendary Pat Patterson is going after the WWF title with Bob Backlund. Quick note before we start talking about this, Barry, I believe this was the fourth in the series of matches between these two guys, and this was the match that was supposed to have been Roddy Piper's match. But, of course, there was a big kerfluffle with Roddy Piper in the dressing room where they pulled a rib on him and he got upset and left or was asked to leave or whatever. So they added this one more in the series, and that's what turned into, I believe, this match inside the steel cage.
Was that rib, was that the one, and was it Freddie Blassie that put something in his bagpipes?
The toilet paper. He put toilet paper in the bagpipes.
Yeah. I'm glad that you looked up that stat with the three matches. Did Patterson face Backlund? Was it three matches or four matches?
No, there was a four-match series because
Anybody else ever have that with Backlund before?
No, he had more matches with Backlund in the Garden than anybody did.
That says something.
Yeah. And he was, you know, if I recall from Backlund's book, the one thing he said was that Patterson was definitely his favorite opponent of all time.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of guys that worked with Patterson will tell you that he was one of their favorites too. And ironically, we lost Rocky Johnson earlier this year, and these two were a great tag team out in California, I believe Los Angeles as well as San Francisco, working for Shire. They wrestled each other. They were a team. They were also the best of friends So it's, you know, very sad. And I think when you talk about underrated tag teams, what Patterson and Johnson did out in San Francisco is something that should probably be discussed, you know, especially in the annals of history. But, you know, losing Pat Patterson, he's a professional wrestling legend. This is a guy, and I know we're going to talk deeply about in this episode, but it's a guy that essentially was a headliner everywhere that he went. He was AWA tag team champion. He was a big star in the WWF, obviously. California is well known, you know. Florida had a big impact in Florida, spent about 7, 8, 9 months with us down there. But literally anywhere he went, they were giving him a title. He was getting a big push. And he is really, I think, he's one of those guys, when you look, he was a major star in the three big companies in the U.S. And not a lot of guys can say that, you know. There are a few. We had Ken Patera a couple of weeks ago. And Ken Patera, you know, big star in the Federation, AWA, obviously, and then select territories in the NWA. But I'm glad that you chose this match, first off, because it's a really good match. And this match, I think what I really like about it is, hey, you've got two guys that are really working well together, and you can see it. So you adding the context of Backlund saying that Patterson was his favorite opponent really makes a lot of sense here, because when you watch these two, it's almost flawless. Like, you know, I don't know what their line of communication was, and I didn't see them calling any spots. I'm sure that they were. At the same time, they work flawlessly together. So yeah, I'll read off some of my notes. Howard Finkel, this was kind of, and I mentioned this to our producer, the chef extraordinaire, Sweet Lou Kippelman, before we started recording. But last week we talked about Finkel for only 5 or 6 minutes. And I put a poll up in the Facebook group of your favorite part of the last episode. And I think 2 or 3 people actually said the Howard Finkel discussion, which really I thought was really nice that people did care. But again, when you watch Finkel, the big difference to me, Howard Finkel versus any other ring announcer, maybe Michael Buffer might be an exception. Finkel made the match really important by the way he was announcing it. And when you watch these attractive females that work in the Federation now, and look, they're beautiful. Charlie Caruso, you know, whoever it is, they're gorgeous and they're not bad, but it doesn't lend importance to the match. When you watch Finkel do these introductions, you fucking know it is about to go down. And that to me, you can't fake that. You can't replicate that.
One of the things that he was a master of was the dramatic pause.
Yes.
You know, when he would talk about the next month's card and he would say, you know, appearing next month on a Madison Square Garden card, WWF champion Bob Backlund will face. And there'd be like this dramatic pause and he'd go, Pat Patterson in a cage match. And the crowd would just friggin' lose their mind. And he played it so well. And, you know, we've talked before. I don't mean to interrupt your train of thought, Bear.
No, that's good.
You know, like we've talked about legendary ring announcers, Jimmy Lennon at the Olympic in L.A., Dr. Tom Miller in Greensboro at the Greensboro Coliseum. And I know that, what was the guy in Miami? Was it Frank Freeman?
Frank Freeman, the great
Freeman. You know, you said was a great one. And I always loved the guy that, and I don't even know his name, the guy that was in West Palm Beach. Was a great ring announcer.
Yes, he was.
And do we include David Penzer in that group? No, probably not. But anyway, so there have been others, and you know, you said Michael Buffer and his brother too gets lots of play in UFC and such like that. But the ones that first of all have that just ability to project the voice and include the sense of drama as they're promoting next month's card, I think that's a real key.
It is. And that's, and so, yeah. So with me just talking in circles, you were able to nail that down, Jeff. That's exactly it. And you're, look again, wait, it's a little early in the episode, Jeff.
Right, go ahead. Say it.
Drum roll, please. Jeff, Jeff, you are 100% correct.
Check.
So yeah, it was, but
people out there in the audience that wait for that check, by the way.
They did. I saw that in the Facebook group this week as well. So they really are. A couple of things also. So Backlund is really good here. And I know Backlund gets a lot of shit, especially in hindsight. You know, there's a myth perpetuated about Backlund that I don't believe are legitimate, that he wasn't drawn, whatever it is. Superstar Billy Graham certainly is extremely critical. I believe that's all based out of bitterness. You know, I know it's all based out of bitterness. But with that, Backlund is not as exaggerated as he would become in a year or two, because he still is this. He's still the white meat all-American baby.
Oh yeah, no, he was definitely over at this point. His spiral downward as champion had not started yet.
That's what I was going to say to you or ask you, because he gets a really great reception here, and I do know that in the 80s that did start to change a little bit. So when did that change? Was that this match being 79? Was that like by 81 or so that things?
I want to say that you definitely noticed it with Snuka. I don't know if you noticed it before Snuka, but definitely by the time Snuka was his opponent, he was getting openly heckled and booed, I think, by some of the home base, you know, the Madison Square Garden, the bigger cities were really letting him have it. And, you know, it's funny because I know Vince McMahon Sr. had some sort of policy where I'm going to give you the day you're going to win the title and the day you're going to lose the title. But, you know, I mean, you're in the biggest media city in the world, you know, for wrestling. And, you know, maybe Tokyo is a fair argument, but, you know, in this country, definitely. And I'm sorry, when your crowd starts telling you that it's time to do something with your champion, and, you know, you easily could have done it with whether it's Valentine, we've talked about, whether it's Morocco or somebody else, you needed to have that guy in the on deck circle ready to take over. Because Backlund's time just at some point wore thin, and it was really noticeable.
Yeah, definitely by the end it was. He also changed his look. He was wearing a singlet. You know, here he's still wearing the plain tights and the plain boots. But I guess for me, it was the reception he got was huge. You know, when Backlund came out.
Oh, no, yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
people were really just losing their minds. But I do remember later, and of course, the narrative now on Backlund is, you know, that he wasn't a drawing champion. There's just a lot of criticism. I think without taking into account that those first few years, this guy was a super tremendously over talent. Pat Patterson's punches, Jeff, it's something that I remember seeing as a kid. And he had kind of an unusual punch, but it always looked real. It was kind of the like a bolo wind-up punch, but it wasn't. He had an unusual movement when he went in for his punches, but yet they always looked like they were connecting, which I liked. What really got me about this match, and I think this is where if you understand the psychology of professional wrestling, and I'm talking guys like Patterson, Ray Stevens, I'm talking old school territorial guys, they've got the spot where Patterson is trying to climb over the cage to win, which I think, you know, I don't think currently that's the way you win a cage match, right? You can pin somebody now, I think, but in the old days, it used to have to be you had to climb out of the cage, and Backlund is holding on to his leg, and it probably goes on for 3 or 4 minutes, but it's so realistic. It's so believable because they're there. The facial expressions on Patterson, just unbelievable. I love it. Backlund becomes a bloody mess. Patterson also becomes a bloody mess. Definitely not at the same level of Backlund because Backlund is really bleeding here, which is also, I think, adds serious importance to the match. And then the finish is great. You know, it's a finish that we've seen numerous times where, you know, basically Backlund falls through the cage door and wins. But at the same time, it's so dramatic. And when that happens, again, we've talked numerous times, Jeff, about how important a crowd is. That fucking crowd loses their mind when he falls out of the cage.
He takes one hell of a bump because he slides backwards down the steps. And as I watched it, I was like, fuck, that must have hurt.
Yeah, it had to hurt, actually. I agree with you on that one, too. And he does. He takes a hell of a bump, and then Patterson's in the ring. And the beauty of this is, too, you know, Patterson's not done selling at this point. Patterson's in the ring, and they even make mention Patterson's upset. He's angry, and they go to him, and he looks like, you know, he just looks like he just lost his best friend. This is such a stellar matchup. And I love the fact that you relayed that little factoid about Patterson being Backlund's favorite opponent, because when you watch this, this is, you know, you don't get matches like this every day. It just, and again, this is not a match that is, you know, there's no great spot that I can tell you about that's death defying or anything like that. It is really how fluid and perfect this match is, but how comfortable these two are working with each other.
And, you know, as I sit there and watch this match, I was doing, you know, the quick math. When this match took place, I believe Patterson would have been 39 years old. So he was, I'm not going to say he was past his prime. I know he only worked another couple of years. He had the program with Slaughter. And I think that pretty much wrapped up his career. You know, he didn't end up going into his late 40s like some guys do, and even into their 50s. But, you know, you think about one of the great sort of tragedies is, you know, Dave Meltzer has talked about when he was growing up in the San Francisco and the Bay Area, the matches that he would have seen with yeah. Ray Stevens or Pat Patterson that just aren't out there. And, you know, to see matches with not just those two guys, but you mentioned Rocky Johnson, you know, Peter Maivia, guys, when the area was just absolutely on fire, how great it would have been to see those matches. Now, of course, you know, Patterson came down to Florida, and I know he had the tag team. Was it with Saito and Koloff at different occasions?
No, so this was the greatest lineage of tag team wrestling. So it was Patterson and Koloff that were a team. They split. Patterson wound up leaving the state, and it's we can definitely get into it. And then Koloff and Saito formed a team.
Okay.
Now, gotcha. Just imagine a in his prime Ivan Koloff with in his prime Mr. Saito as a tag team.
Sure.
I mean, through the fucking roof. And then it wound up Mr. Saito and Mr. Sato, who became the Great Kabuki. And all three of those teams were just fantastic.
So what I was going to ask was that, you know, I know there's clips, there's really not many entire matches, but are there a lot of clips of the Patterson Koloff team that are out there?
I don't think I've ever seen one, and I hate to, it really sucks. They were that good. And it's funny, somebody posted a match. It may have been our old friend Jesus, but somebody posted a match, and it was a match of Koloff versus Patterson from the WWF, or I guess WWWF. So they had worked against each other. They had been a tag team. They just, these also were two guys that could really, but they're two French Canadians, probably easier to communicate as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So let's talk now, Barry. You had the chance, along with your partner, the esteemed David Cash Money Penzer, to bring Pat Patterson down to the CWF Legends with his old partner in the WWF Stooges, Jerry Briscoe. And we had a great time down there with Pat Patterson. And, you know, we told the story once before. I don't even know how many episodes it was. It's been a couple of years now. But of the night that Pat Patterson and Bertrand Hébert went to the International Beer Garden near the hotel.
Yeah, it was. So it's been a little over 2 years. It was November, the first week of November in 2018. And, you know, this was an interesting one. Because Patterson wasn't a guy, that I had ever really thought about for a fan fest in regards to the fact that he really wasn't doing a lot of fan fests. And I didn't, I always look for a guy that maybe is more local, whatever it is. And as it turns out, Pat was going to be in town because I think he was doing the Jericho cruise. And Pat was going to be in town. Bertrand Hébert, who was his co-author of his autobiography, very excellent autobiography, by the way, and they somehow got in touch. I guess Bertrand got in touch with Cash Money, David Penzer, and Penzer said, would you be interested? And I said, you know, absolutely. I never thought that was a reality, getting him. And immediately I'm like, we should pair him with Jerry Briscoe. That to me is the natural pairing, because not only did they receive national acclaim on the big stage up in, you know, as the Stooges for Vince McMahon and the WWE, but they also worked against each other. They were opponents dozens of times in the state of Florida in 1977. So, and they were also best friends. And I should say, I reached out to Jerry Briscoe today when I learned of Pat's passing. And I said to him, I gave him my condolences, knowing how close they were. And he came back and he said, it's very tough on me. It's very tough to lose a best friend. And I just, you know, there was a certain sadness to his text that I could tell. So so we were really fortunate to have Pat and Jerry there. And Pat is outspoken. Pat will tell you stories. And, you know, Pat told us some of the stories two or three times, Jeff, probably a safe way to say. we heard some of these stories numerous times, but it was a thrill to have a professional wrestling legend that I don't think I ever was ever on my radar for ever doing the fan fest. And I should also add, we also had Rick Hunter there. Rick Hunter, a lot of people know Rick Hunter as the Gladiator, Ricky Hunter. He was doing jobs on television for the Federation in the mid 80s. I think he had received that job through Pat Patterson because they were lifelong friends. And he also did some referee work. But Rick Hunter, I think now, and he's at probably 85, 86 years old. I didn't know this ahead of time, but we invited Rick to come and see. And I believe Pat had been the best man at Rick's wedding. Wow. So without even knowing that ahead of time. So this was a big deal on a lot of levels. And I got to tell you, we've had 6 fan fests so far. We unfortunately no fan fest this year, which, you know, and then next year might be in question as well. But I will be eternally grateful for the 6 that we've had. These are amazing memories. And I have a bunch of memories, but I got to say the memory of Pat Patterson sitting in the lobby with us the night before, and there's only 7 or 8 of us in this lobby, and Pat's holding court. You know, we're getting him beer. And if you remember, we were getting beer and charging it to David Penzer. Do you remember that?
I have no knowledge of that, but...
because Penzer, somebody, so I think it was Bob. This is great. I don't know if we ever told this story. So Bobby Van Cavalar films almost every interaction. Like, he'll put it on Facebook Live. So
I think Bobby may videotape himself taking a dump. That's how often he's got the camera. I'm just ribbing you, Bobby.
Yeah. Well, you may be right too. But so Bobby's filming Pat talking, and we're getting beer from, you know, the hotel's got a machine, a cooler, whatever, and you can get beer, soda, and charge it to a room. And we're taking stuff out, and she's saying, "What's your room?" And I'm going, "It's the David Penzer account."
And Bobby, I can't believe you didn't say, "Put it on the Underhills tab." So no,
put it on Penzer was too good. I couldn't test that. So, but Bobby's filming this. Next thing you know, literally 30 seconds later, my fucking phone rings, and it's Penzer going, "What the fuck are you doing? Charging shit to my room?" that was hysterical. I was like, "Dave, relax. We're just having a little fun." But we were getting beer for Pat and beverages for everybody else. But Pat sat at a chair in the hotel and held court, and it probably went on, Jeff, I'll say 90 minutes without knowing how long it went. And it might be, you know, we'll get into the whole international beer garden deal. But even beyond that, just the stories were really incredible. And the fact that he didn't have a filter in the middle of a hotel lobby presented another challenge, because I kept looking over at the lady behind the desk at the hotel. And I
getting increasingly horrified.
Yeah, she was the nicest woman ever. And I went later and I remember her. Yeah. And I went over and I apologized, and she's like, "Oh no, no." She's like from like Fargo, Minneapolis. She's like, "No, dear, it's fine. It's fine." Really. But the bigger issue was, if you remember, Jeff, behind us was about 30 preteen softball players. There was some sort of softball or baseball tournament that was taking place with middle schoolers. And there's probably 30 or 40 of them, some with their parents, and they're on the other side of the lobby. And Paps dropped, you know, he's fucked this and fucking in the ass, and he's going, and we're sitting there going, "Oh, this is gold." I mean, first off, you know, but at the same time, how long until one of these like dads comes over and is like, "Could you guys shut the fuck up? Could you keep this down?" And we're like, "This is Pat fucking Patterson, man. We can't ask him to do that." But that is, you know, if you said to me, "Give me 5 memories of a fan fest," that's definitely in the 5, and that may even be number 1. It just really was a special, special moment that you could never recreate under any circumstance, and something completely unexpected for all of us.
Yeah, no,
but Jeff, as we were sitting there, the next thing we noticed walking through the doors were 2 attractive young females, fairly scantily clad, with a shorter, slightly muscular, what looked to be Hispanic gentleman directly behind them. Do you remember this?
Oh, yes. That, like you said, this of all the Legends Fan Fest, and I've been to all of them, I think this, you know what was great about this? And I agree, this was probably the moment of all the fan fest. So we're sitting there, and I'm trying to think who all was sitting there. I know Travis was with us. You recall anybody else that was sitting with us?
I think Aaron Grafton was there.
Yeah, Aaron Grafton.
Randy Rusk, maybe Harold. I don't remember always exactly who was there. Yeah. I think Mark Beaudry was there. I remember having a conversation with him, but yeah.
And so we're sitting there and we see these three coming into the lobby and kind of, they look over at our group and then they start walking towards the person behind the front desk. And I remember I kind of leaned into you, and before I even had a chance to say anything, you go, oh, this is going to be interesting. Something's going on here. And I was like, yep. And we sort of like, we're almost doing like a play-by-play of what we thought was going to happen.
I do remember that.
And so like, and the girls are looking at it and they're like, you know, as you said, they were kind of scantily clad and they kind of just start, you know, putting themselves out there, and they're doing it in the direction of Pat.
Yes.
And, you know, they certainly weren't doing it to Travis or Aaron Grafton, that's for sure. And so anyway, so they're kind of like, you know, dare I say, shaking the moneymaker at Pat. And so then they come over and they go, and they sort of like put their arms around Pat. Oh, we remember you from over at the beer garden. Do you remember us? And Pat's like, huh, what, you know? And yeah, so these two young, I'm going to put it out there, these young floozies decide they're going to try to, sway with their feminine wiles this older gay gentleman, which was just fucking hilarious, you know, because of course they didn't know. And they might as well have been trying to seduce Jim fucking Barnett, you know. Yes. And so Pat just had zero interest whatsoever. And so they kept going, oh yeah, you were there with your friend. And the whole thing we kind of figured out was some sort of credit card thing
where they were scammed.
And what had happened,
Jeff, was, so, and we should say Bertrand was not in the lobby with us.
No, he had gone upstairs. Yeah.
Which is interesting because Bertrand should have been there and he wasn't. But they had gone to the International Beer Garden, and apparently the service was so bad, and I forget all the details about it, but the service was so bad that they wound up walking out. They hadn't spent any money or anything, as far as I remember.
Think about this. You have two French Canadian guys who are in a place that is known for its beer, who are served so poorly that they choose to walk out.
Yeah, exactly. And one, Pat was a big drinker. I mean,
no, that's what I meant. You know, two French Canadian guys. Yeah.
So they did walk out, and Bertrand, I think, was so upset that he immediately got on Yelp and he wrote a review. The manager of the place saw this. This is all taking place in real time within minutes. The manager saw the Yelp review and then apparently sent these two floozies with the very silent, nonverbal, Hispanic, slightly muscular bodyguard over to have a conversation. However, the one caveat to all that, Jeff, if I'm recalling correctly, was they had made up some fictitious story about, we have a credit card belonging to Mr. Herbert, being Bertrand Hebert. We want to give it to him.
Yeah, we wanted to come outside so we could.
Yes, exactly. There was no credit card. There was nothing. But as Jeff said, these two women and the one with the, she had like that kind of silverish gray hair that was trendy for a while. I think it's gone now. She was kind of attractive. The other one, not as much. And this is what I remember. They, not only were they trying to flirt with Pat tremendously to get to Bertrand, where's your friend? He was cute, that kind of shit. They were also talking to Pat like he was, mentally brain damaged. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Where's your friend? Like he's either deaf or, you know, it was the most bizarre thing we ever saw.
Yeah, it was one of those things that was so stinking. I'm trying to see if I have the photo. Because sweet Lou here may not be familiar with the story, so I'm going to pass the floozies on to Lou. So Lou can objectify and make fun of them like we did. We'll have to find it later. So, yeah, it was just this moment of craziness where we're all sitting there and we all know what's going on. But yet somehow they're thinking we haven't figured it out yet. You know, right. And that's part of what made it so much fun. And why don't you call your friend and have him come down so we can talk to him? And Pat is completely kayfabing him. What friend? I don't have a friend here. What are you fucking talking about? And oh my God, just watching the proverbial two girls play the role of the hamster on the wheel, where they kept going and going and going and going, and they weren't getting anywhere.
No, and what was so funny about it was, yeah, they're trying to work Pat. Pat was having a blast with it. If you remember, he was
absolutely.
No anger. He was totally fucking enjoying it. But I don't want to call the three individuals from the International Beer Garden stupid, but for all intents and purposes, Jeff, they were pretty fucking stupid. And they really were. And they were trying to work all of us, including Pat. But, you know, look, we've been around professional wrestling in one form or another for almost 50 years now. I mean, you've got people that, you know, we saw through your line of bullshit in about 2 seconds. You know, it just like you weren't going to do it. On that note, though, it was really a lot of fun for us because we really were perpetuating it. And then wasn't there something where somebody, and I'm thinking it might have been Grafton, Aaron Grafton, offered to buy
a he tried to buy him a beer.
Yeah.
Grafton working the any port in a storm routine.
Yeah. You can't blame him. You know what I mean? It's yeah. But that was clearly a lot of fun. And then we kept it up. And then I remember that when we got back and we did a recap of the Fan Fest on the podcast, there was a great outpouring of, you know, people just love this story, that people then started either calling or messaging the Beer Garden and basically harassing the Beer Garden over this whole situation. And I just thought that was really funny, too. But that was a great time. We were also really fortunate in that Pat did karaoke for us. And this was something that was a passion of his. He was known for it, that he would do karaoke at a drop of a hat everywhere. And it wasn't like Pat was amazing at karaoke either. Let's say, you know, I'm not a good singer by any stretch.
His enthusiasm for it was epic. Yes.
Yeah. And the fact he didn't give a fuck. I mean, that was even the better part. He's like, I'm having fun. I'm going to do this. He did. He had a tremendous enthusiasm for it. And it was very sweet at the end of the night. You know, everybody says, My Way by Frank Sinatra is Pat's song, which it is. And when he did that rendition of My Way, it was a kind of a big deal for us because, you know, we realized, hey, this is Pat Patterson in front of us. And this is not something that's probably ever going to happen with us ever again. You know, it was a really, really big deal. So, you know, just what an honor to be able to have Pat Patterson at a Fan Fest. But, you know, to be able to pair him with Jerry, you know, this is a friendship that probably was close to 50 years, somewhere around that frame right there. And a lot of respect between those two, a lot of territories worked together, a lot of time spent together. And, you know, Jeff, as we get older, and I know we discuss this, we talk about it, you certainly have had some health issues this year that, you know, as we get older and all this shit starts to happen and we lose people, you know, that we watch that entertained us on a daily basis, we're losing people left and right. At what point, you know, from our standpoint, at what point are all of our legends and all of our heroes gone? And, you know, it's when I say that, I am saying you and I specifically, you know, guys that are in their mid to late 50s, at what point is it basically over for us? The younger generation, you'll always have a lot of these guys, your Shawn Michaels or whatever it is, you know, just a name to pull out of a hat. But for us, you know, we're losing, you know, we've lost so many of these guys and we continue to lose them. And it's, you know, I say it all the time, you know, if you can meet them, if you can even correspond with them, you know, I hear all the time, people ask me all the time, Jeff, if you could have somebody at a Fan Fest that you're running, your Fan Fest, and it's somebody that worked in Florida that's no longer with us, who would it be? And that list, Jeff, is 500 names long. But one name that I always think about is Sir Oliver Humperdinck, because Sir Oliver Humperdinck, when I started the old CWF archives, the website, he was the first guy in the business that reached out to me. And he basically said, I want to thank you. This is fantastic. I've spent hours on here. He gave me his phone number and I'm sitting there and this is before Facebook. So I'm fucking, you know, I think I'm wetting myself. I'm so excited. This is Sir Oliver Humperdinck. This is a big deal. And he was just such a real human being. But where I'm going with this is I hear all the time whenever a picture of Humperdinck is posted, somebody will say, oh, I used to communicate with him all the time. We would not only talk wrestling, but we would talk baseball or we would talk jazz. He was a real big jazz aficionado. And how important it is to those people that they were able to communicate with him. Like it really means something to those people. So, you know, I encourage you, if you don't have the means to get somewhere, and certainly with, you know, what's taken place since March of this year, there aren't a lot of options out there. But if you can either Facebook friend or shoot an email or somehow get in touch with somebody who meant something to you, you'd really be surprised at just how receptive a lot of these people are, how thrilled they are to hear from you, that you remember what they did. That's a big deal.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned Hump and his love of like baseball and jazz. And think about Kevin Sullivan, just a huge, huge baseball fan from his younger days. And, you know, if you find that that little niche that they love outside of the wrestling world, if they've got some sort of, you know, passion or interest outside the wrestling world and you find out about it, you know, hell, we could have Barry, we could have Kevin Sullivan on this podcast and literally do an hour and a half podcast of him just talking about baseball and the Boston Red Sox and different angles on baseball and not ever bring up wrestling. And I bet you Kevin Sullivan would get off there and go, well, that was kind of refreshing. I didn't sit there and talk about fucking wrestling for an hour and a half. I talked baseball, this other interest. And if we could have had a chance to talk to Hump, you know, if we could sit there and talk with Hump about music for an hour and a half, I mean, it would have been refreshing to him that someone else has an interest like he does outside of the world of wrestling. Of course, it'd be fun to talk to Kevin and Hump about wrestling. You know, if we had had the chance or if we have the chance eventually down the road again with Kevin. But I mean, like, you know, to be able to talk with somebody other than what is perceived as, you know, your primary interest, or, you know, it's like somebody like me, you know, if, you know, knowing that I worked for 30 plus years at the courthouse, if somebody came up and instead of talking about the courthouse, they talk about some other interest I have, you know, movies or music or something, that'd be kind of cool. Or if instead of talking to you about, you know, your years in the restaurant business and as a server, they decided to talk to you about, you know, your love for new wave music of the early 80s. That's the kind of stuff that you go, yeah, wow, I haven't talked a lot about this. And it you know, it sparks a little interest in you. And so, yeah, that makes it a lot of fun. And I think, you know, when you find that little niche that or that little item in someone's life that they love other than what they're primarily known for, I think it really strikes a chord with the person.
It does. So two notes with that. One is when we sat, we had breakfast on Sunday morning, the day after the Fan Fest. It was me, yourself, Kevin Sullivan, and J.J. Dillon. And we sat at a table at least for an hour. And it was only the four of us. And I don't think professional wrestling was even discussed once. It was, if I'm correct, it was only baseball. And
both guys, huge baseball guys.
Yeah. And both guys also, and also like the best of friends, Kevin and JJ, I think both saying that that's their closest friend in professional wrestling. So that the rapport there between the two of them, but they were also discussing the baseball books that they were reading at the time. Do you remember that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So to the second thing that you just said, you're right. Look, when we do these interviews, and I don't know if they're even interviews, are they chats more than anything else? We don't want to ask the same questions that have been asked 100 times. Somebody reached out to me after the Ken Patera interview. And of course, you know what they said, Jeff. I don't have to even tell you. What did they say?
Oh, why didn't you ask him about the McDonald's thing?
There you go. Yeah. And why? Because they've only been asked, Ken's only been asked 8,000 times about McDonald's. You can go get on YouTube if you want to know what he thinks about that. And there's your answer right there. Instead, we try to focus on stuff that isn't quite in the mainstream, which is why sometimes we do ask these offbeat questions.
And think about the fact that, you know, to me at least, we could sit there and rehash the fucking McDonald's story with him, have him be contentious with him because he doesn't really want to talk about it.
Right.
Or I could mention, hey, you know, I'm a huge Vikings fan since going back to the late 60s. And I remember your brother was the D-line coach there. And all of a sudden, Ken Patera opens up this fucking vein about the time that his brother called him with the news that he didn't have long to live. I mean, that was fucking spellbinding to me, you know? When else have you heard Ken Patera open up a personal vein like that? It just doesn't happen to me. That is far more interesting than a rehashing of something that happened, let's be honest, over 35 fucking years ago.
Yeah. And again, look, there's a million articles out there, whether it's on YouTube or it's in print online. You want the answer, you can search it. But as Jeff said, look, we opened the door a little bit. And then we just, you know, look, Ken was really, well, I was going to say Ken was unedited. That isn't true, right?
No,
I guess that's a lie.
There was some editing.
All right. There's a lot of editing there. But at the same time, you know, look, we had Jeff and I go into all these chats with a list of questions, and we don't share the questions with each other. We basically just pass it off. You know, Jeff says, okay, you're up. Jeff, it's your turn, whatever it is. But, you know, with Ken, he had his own agenda, what he wanted to talk about. And really, isn't that more interesting to hear somebody what they want to say versus what we want to hear?
Anyway, so we look forward to chatting to our friend Bertrand Hébert and discussing the legacy and life of the great Pat Patterson. And I have to believe, you know, as much as we, in our own way, shit on Vince McMahon and his some of his policies as an employer, you know, this is one of those cases. I would be absolutely stunned if this one did not hit Vince McMahon personally in a way that very few do. You know, because this is a guy that worked for him for 40 fucking years. And, you know, this was not a guy that was just some other employee. And I'm not poo-pooing it, you know, I know recently there were some people that we know and care about that have lost their position, that hope to regain their position after the start of the new year. But, you know, I think Pat's death is really going to hit Vince personally. And I would be absolutely stunned if, whether it's on SmackDown, Raw, or whatever, if there's not some glowing, glowing tribute to the life and legacy of Pat Patterson.
I think there has to be. I think when you look, I think you can put a lot of the success, pardon me, of the WWF, WWE on Pat Patterson, because a lot of the ideas, the Royal Rumble is the big one that everybody pulls out, that he's a guy that came up with the concept, you know, based off of the Battle Royal that took place with Shire in San Francisco. But at the same time, a lot of the booking philosophies and booking ideas did come from Patterson. A lot of these ideas did. And, you know, I think what we're seeing now with Vince versus what you were seeing 30 and 35 years ago, Vince would surround himself with some of the best minds in professional wrestling, Patterson being one of those. That isn't really the case any longer. It's not happening.
Yeah, but you know, it's funny. You mentioned how these people that we may have grown up watching, guys like Patterson and Rocky Johnson and stuff like that, are passing as we get older. And you mentioned that the generation underneath us, shall we say, that were fans of guys like Shawn Michaels and people like that. Well, who do you think that Shawn Michaels and probably large part learned his craft from? It's having a guy like fucking Pat Patterson in the locker room, you know, where you can go to and say, you know, we're trying to work out this idea for a finish. And, you know, then he would go to one. And let me tell you something. If you don't think guys like Michaels, Bret Hart, I'm going to say it, Kevin Nash, all those guys, Hogan, all those guys went to Patterson looking for advice on finishes and things like that. You know, I mean, I'm sorry. I just have to believe that's true.
I would agree too. And I think even if they didn't actively seek it out, I have a feeling that Pat was probably imparting his knowledge, because that's, you know, look, you want to run a successful company, and for years, you know, still is a successful company, but you know, he was your encyclopedia. And, yeah, you know, without a lot of that, one of the things I've always wanted to do, and I'm shocked with the plethora of wrestling books that are out there. Jeff, there are wrestling, there are autobiographies.
Good usage of the word plethora, by the way, Barry.
Very good, right? Very good. There are books out there. There's autobiographies. There's biographies. Some guy wrote a book about having dinner with professional wrestlers. But there's every theme out there. Nobody's touched on different angles and booking philosophies. And years ago, probably 4 years ago, I was really tempted to write a book on booking, just on booking bookers and their philosophies. And I actually reached out to 4 or 5 wrestlers, and I got quotes, I got ideas. I still have it. I just, you know, I have 20 things in the works, and I'll never complete any of it, right?
You know, I will say, Barry, there is one person that you did not reach out to for thoughts on their booking philosophy.
Who would that be, Jeff? Well, Jeff, see, there's a difference.
Still available. They call me Booker. I knew I was going to work it in here somewhere before the end. They call me Booker, and Breaking Kayfabe, Dinner with the Legends of Wrestling, still available through Crowbar Press. Or, as I said last week, you can reach out to me through Facebook Messenger about having a personalized autographed copy. Oh, and we will get it to you in time for the holidays. Thank you.
Are these on Amazon as well, Jeff?
I'm almost positive they are. Okay. But why would you want to go through Amazon when you can go through me personally?
No, you don't. And we should say, look, I actually like Amazon a lot. I watch Amazon Prime probably on a daily basis. I shop at Whole Foods. I get books delivered in like 24 hours. I love Amazon Prime and Crowbar Press. Look, they do a nice job. At the same time, go through Jeff directly. There's no reason to go through other people. Go through
Jeff.
Especially
with my new supply freshly sent to me of of each.
And
of
they smell good, right? They smell good, Jeff.
Well, yeah, I'll spray them if you want. You know,
that's
what would be like Dracar Noir, maybe a little Brut, something like that. Well, Barry, I never asked you. Did you ever have a cologne of choice? Well, we've really gone off the rails here.
I did. We really have gone off the, but these are always the best shows. Yes. So I did have a cologne of choice, and then I'll give you an addendum to it. So Royal Copenhagen.
That's so funny. That was totally fucking my cologne. Yeah. Royal Copenhagen. Absolutely. Yeah,
which was really fantastic. And then I switched to Dracar Noir, as you said, in the 80s. But when I was working, Jeff, have I ever mentioned that I worked in restaurants in New York?
Probably not in the last 4 or 5 episodes.
4 or 5 minutes. That's what I thought.
Oh, no, the other 155 episodes, you definitely mentioned it, but not in the last.
But when I was working in I was managing this restaurant in New York, and I was wearing cologne, and the owner pulls me over, and he goes like, "I want to compliment you." And I was like, "What do you mean?" He goes, "You look really good. Your package, you got your package.
your package looked really good." Okay. We have discovered the title of this week's episode. Your package, your package looks really good. I'm making a note of that. Go ahead.
Yeah, he goes, it's not going to be because you have a nice looking package. No, what he was saying was, he goes, the package looks good. There's no way I could dig.
Keep digging the hole. Go ahead.
Exactly. There's no way I'm getting out of this. What he said, and I'm certainly fucking this up tremendously, was I had on a $300 suit that probably looked twice as expensive. I was young. I had a full head of hair. I was in great shape and I smelled good. And so he said, you know, you're what we look for in this restaurant. And I got to tell you, your cologne, what cologne is that? It's fantastic. I said, oh, it's Dracar Noir. And he goes, you know, to me, cologne is one of those things that I don't think enough men wear. He goes, but I got to tell you, if I went to a restaurant and I ordered a $45 steak, I would want to smell the $45 steak and not the $45 cologne. And I knew that he was in the nicest way telling me, don't wear cologne to work anymore.
Gotcha.
And I never did that. And I think that was the end of it for me right there. I don't think I've worn cologne since.
It was either that or he wanted to fuck you. I don't know which one.
Nice pack. Yeah.
You did have a full head of hair back then. That's all.
I did. Yeah.
So anyway, so. All right. So, we raise an adult beverage to the memory of our friend, the late Pat Patterson, to his legacy, to his memory, one of the all time unquestioned great minds in the history of the wrestling business. We'll see you. We'll see you on the other side, my friend. Very interesting story that came up through, of all people, the lovely Mrs. Bowdrin. So Mrs. Bowdrin tells me that, she goes to the next town north of us, which is Dawsonville, Georgia, to get the old hair done, probably on an increasingly frequent basis, but I digress. So she tells me that on one prior visit, her hairdresser and her were, chit-chatting the way a lady and her hairdresser would, and that she had mentioned, they got to talking about wrestling. And apparently the hairdresser's son, who plays football, big wrestling fan. And so she says, my wife says, well, my husband, has followed wrestling for, his entire life. And a matter of fact, he's written a couple books about it. And so she said, really? She said, yeah. So she's telling him about that. And so my wife went the other day for the next visit. And so the woman says, oh, I got to tell you a funny story. She says, I go home and after your last visit, I told my son. And by the way, this is a shout out to Ethan in Dawsonville, Georgia. I'm going to explain why I'm giving him a shout out in a second. And she goes to Ethan and she says, Ethan, I'm talking to this client of mine whose husband has written a couple of wrestling books. We were talking about you. And he apparently has his, a podcast. And she says, really? What's the guy's name? And so she's going, well, I'm trying to think, his name is Jeff. It's Jeff something. And he's trying to remember my wife's last name. So the son apparently says to his mom, wait a minute. Is his name Jeff Bowdrin by any chance? And she goes, yeah, that's it, Jeff Bowdrin. She goes, wait a minute. You have as a client Jeff Bowdrin's wife? I listen to his podcast. So Ethan out there who wants to be a wrestler in the future, on behalf of the good folks here at Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry, myself, Lord Barron's Rose, the chef Luke Kippelman, we say salute and keep those dreams of a wrestling future alive. I mean, how fucking weird is that, Barry, that some kid in Dawsonville, Georgia listens to this podcast?
That's the cool thing too. And I remember, this is probably 2 years ago, I was wearing a Super Studcast t-shirt and I went into my local Wawa and the guy said, he goes, and this is, you know, this was Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. And I went into the Wawa and the guy says, oh, I listened to that podcast, that Ron Fuller. That's a great podcast. And immediately I'm like, yeah, do you listen to Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry? And he goes, I don't know what that is. But yeah,
you got right back down to earth, huh?
Oh, I was I was right back down to earth. I was, yeah. And I don't think the guy listens, but it is kind of cool. It's cool when you're surprised. It was kind of like also, Jeff, if you remember when we first started, you know, 2-3 years ago, there was somebody going into Curiosity Donuts when my children worked there and would say, yeah, I listened to your dad's podcast and stuff. I just thought that was cool. Wasn't even in our Facebook group, just a listener. So I love it. But Dawsonville, Georgia, who would think, right?
Yeah, exactly. So next, Barry, I wanted to mention that friend of the show, Joe Christie, a man that you have referenced on more than one occasion, because he seems to constantly be bringing up the Ethiopian story with you. Am I correct?
Oh, you're 100% correct. Yeah.
So Joe Christie wanted to give us, he said, guys, give us your F, marry, or kill on sandwiches.
Oh.
So Barry, why don't you tell Joe Christie, say, Joe Christie, you motherfucker. Anyway, could you give us your F, marry, or kill on sandwiches?
Yeah. There's no prep on this one. And Joe Christie, Joe's good. It's not just in our group. Anywhere on Facebook, if there's anything related to anything shit or fecal, Joe tagged me. he could be in the most obscure group.
Joe, Mr. Shit Christie, that's his new name.
So it really is. And I pray that it never stops because at this stage, it's I think I still smile every time I see it. So F, marry, or kill. So I'm going to go with kill on a sandwich that I don't really like a whole lot because I want to kill it, right? So I wouldn't care. A tuna fish sandwich, Jeff. I hate tuna fish. Did you know that? I hate fucking.
That's a very fair. I am not a fan of any kind of, like a tuna fish, your shrimps. I'm giving my answers now. I'm glomming on yours, but like anything like that. Do you like deviled ham?
No, not at all. Yeah. No.
And three packs of, okay, good. Please continue.
Potted like chicken in a can, that chicken salad in a can and all that. I wouldn't, but tuna fish to me, look, you and I have had animals for years. I don't see a difference between when I pop open a can of food for one of my animals versus a can of tuna fish. Like,
wait a minute. Just to be completely socially, inept. Let me just say that I'm sure. There is one type of tuna that you do like to eat. Am I correct? Yeah, I'm sorry, ladies. I just had to.
And I do like raw tuna. Well, I like tuna. I like sushi, sashimi. I don't like tuna in a can. It's something about it. So if I never
ate that way about coconut, like you give me a coconut off a tree, split it open. I fucking love that shit. You give me a Mounds bar that's got shredded coconut or was it Almond Joy or Mounds? So one of them.
Both.
And I can't stand that shit, shredded coconut. But right off the tree, crack it open, I'm fucking there.
Sometimes you feel like a nut. Sometimes you don't. Yeah, but I love coconut.
Peter Paul, I'm a Joyce got nuts.
Yeah, I love all coconut, whether off a tree or coconut water I like, or a candy bar, I like it all.
I like it in a nice pina colada.
I love pina. You know, if you like pina coladas and getting caught in the rain.
Yeah, I knew you were going there.
Thank you. I was going there. This is our super cheesy episode, too. What were we calling it? What were we calling this one? This is the nice package.
The package is looking good episode. Although we may change it to the Joe Mr. Shit Christie episode. Well, anyway, so give me your F and your Mary on sandwich.
Okay, so tuna's dead. So I'm going to F the hand-sliced pastrami sandwich on rye bread from Katz's at, I believe, $21 a sandwich. I'm going to F it, but I'm going to marry a sandwich, Jeff, which is a local sandwich called the Schmitter. And it comes from a place in an area. Joe
Schmitter. I'm sorry, that's another topic.
Yes. And it is essentially a grilled sandwich with pepperoni, ham, cheese, and other meats. And they grill it in a shitload of butter. And then they cut it. And when you bite into it, the grease just drips down your hands because it's just so. But and all that grease is all the flavor. So it arguably is the greatest sandwich, or at least one of the greatest sandwiches I have ever had. But I love sandwiches, especially if it's if it's a bad sandwich, I'm out. But if it's a good sandwich and it's creative, you know, anybody can fucking take shit and slap it between two pieces of bread, throw some mustard or mayo on it, call it a sandwich, whatever, you know. But if you get creative and you really do something there, they do another one. And this is not in my wheelhouse, Jeff, maybe you. But they do a Thanksgiving Schmitter, and it's like turkey, cranberry sauce, mashed potatoes, and stuffing, you know, squeezed into a roll. And people who like that swear that's the greatest sandwich.
You know, the wife picked up for Thanksgiving this year, she picked up a turkey that already had some kind of seasoning on it. And usually we get the proverbial one that's just got the regular basting on it, you know, nothing special and exotic. And this one, I don't know if it was like a Cajun seasoning or what. Disappointed. I told the wife, a little disappointed in the old turkey this year. I mean, I ate it, but, you know, usually it's like talking about on Christmas Story, what you look forward to after the turkey is, you know, you get the turkey tetrazzini, you get the turkey sandwiches, the turkey soup, yeah. You know, and that's what you look forward to. And afterwards, I was just like, no. I'm not going to be doing the leftovers on this, but because I did not like the seasoning that was on, and it wasn't something that she had put on there. It was right. The turkey that she bought had that on there.
Two questions, Jeff. Yes. Did that turkey come from Popeyes?
No, it did not.
Because Popeyes does Cajun turkeys for Thanksgiving. Second is, and I don't know how it is. It could be great. It's probably deep fried, so it's probably good. Do you cook up a big batch of bacon for the turkey as well? Like, that's what I did.
We did not.
And my last question, Jeff. How are the mashed potatoes?
Yes, it was about as good as the cranberry sauce. Mrs. Bowdrin, falling down at the gate for getting the mashed potatoes and the cranberry sauce. I've given her numerous amount of shit about that, so we'll forgive her about that. So I'm going to say, Barry, I'm a traditional guy. First of all, I'll say as far as the kill, I am not a guy. You know, you mentioned the tuna. I'm not a guy that is a big egg salad fan. Are you?
Oh, yeah, I like egg salad, actually.
I'm killing the egg salad. For my life, I have been a PB&J man. My go-to, controversial, I know, I like the Peter Pan crunchy peanut butter, not the smooth. Got to be Peter Pan crunchy.
I'm with you on that.
And apple jelly. I go out for breakfast, biscuits. I don't give a shit what kind of jelly I have. Grape, apple, strawberry jam, whatever. But on my PB&J, it's got to be apple jelly. So I'm very particular about that. So I'm going to say, at this point in my life, you know, years ago, I went through a run where I was having the PB&J almost every day for lunch. So at this point, I'm just going to fuck it. Mary, at this point, I'm going to go for a nice tavern ham with Swiss cheese. My favorite, Barry, first of all, fresh slice of bread is always good. I love the White Mountain bread at Publix. I don't know if you ever tried that. That's really good. But if I have my druthers, which, by the way, I think is the first time we've ever used the word druthers here on 166 fucking episodes in, but I like it on the it's the ciabatta bread. Fucking hook that up on a nice ciabatta bread, holy moly, that is some fucking good eating right there. What do you think?
Ciabatta bread is, so there's an underrated bread right there. So ciabatta, in Italian, it means slipper. It's the shape of the bread, which I guess looks like some a slipper.
Solid knowledge there from a guy not Italian. Yeah,
there you go. But in the outside of the bread is crusty and a little chewy. The inside of the bread is soft, but it's a bread. Hey, I always feel this too. When you get to bread, there is nothing worse than eating a sandwich or a hamburger and the bun or the bread just falls apart on you.
True. It's that is absolutely worst. True.
Fucking ciabatta ain't going to happen. If you get ciabatta.
Or you're expecting a nice sandwich and you go to bite into it and the bread is kind of starting to turn a little bit. It hasn't got full on, outdated. But it's like at this point, it's not soft and it doesn't feel fresh. And you kind of go, nah, okay, yeah. And, just loses something in the experience. That's why you go for the nice ciabatta or the nice, as I mentioned, this endorsement for Publix and their white mountain bread available in the bakery section. The first couple of days on the white mountain bread, oh, stellar berry. So
I'm going to try that too. Yeah, I'm going to try that because I'm going to be in Virginia.
Really? Planning on stopping by to see anybody that may have been a former member of our group?
Oh. No. Still listens, though. I got to say he keeps in contact, still listens. But I have to head down to Virginia in, I think it's February or March. And that's actually the northernmost Publix is in Virginia. So I'm going to stop up and I'm going to load up with some stuff. And I'm going to make a point now to get some of this bread that you just mentioned, because I love everything from Publix.
Barry, we are honored to be joined on this sad, sad occasion of the passing of the legendary Pat Patterson by Bertrand Hébert, who, of course, was the person that wrote Pat's autobiography with him, Accepted. As I've said before, definitely one of my, geez, if it's not my favorite wrestling biography of all time, it's definitely in the top two or three, and the list doesn't go very far. It's exceptional. It's not only a look at Pat's career, and it goes into great detail and depth into his start in, Montreal, up in the Northeast, like in Vermont and stuff like that. Goes into great detail of his work with Roy Scheider. But, you know, the other thing that I found fascinating, and I'll be honest with you, Bertrand, I did not expect this to be the case. The struggle that he had and what he went through as a gay man in an industry like professional wrestling that is thought to be so macho and not accepting. No pun intended, because of course his biography is called Accepted. But the first thing I want to talk to you about, and again, thank you for joining us, your thoughts on Pat as a young man being gay, joining an industry that is perceived as being so anti-gay, and the struggles he went through.
That's the beauty. I mean, there were some incidents along the way, but even early on with Tony Santos' group, I mean, there was other wrestlers that were gay. That's where he meets Louis, and they were going to spend the next 40 years together. And I think the thing people don't really understand about wrestling is that it's all about making money and drawing people and having good matches. So if you have someone who can pull it off, you know, they didn't care he was gay. I mean, Roy Scheider, that's the first thing he was going to tell him. I heard you're special. And, you know, you look like shit. Go to the gym. And then Pat tells him that he's gay. And it's like, well, you know, he goes home at night and said to Louis, I don't think we're going to last long. And 14 years later, you know, he's the one leaving and, you know, leaving the Scheider behind because, you know, he ended up almost becoming his right arm. So it is a funny business for that, is that you would expect that it would have been full of issues along the way, but very early on they became those two guys that did their job, that were very professional in everything they did. And Pat was such a wrestling savant that, you know, right off the bat he would, like, you know, get everyone in his back pocket because he was amazing. I mean, he's telling that story about Pat O'Connor, you know, being very a cheap guy, never buying a beer to anyone and, you know, being able to split the penny in two. And after, you know, he let Pat lead a match, Pat offers to buy him a beer because they had that, like, barn burner. And Pat O'Connor told him, you know, I'm buying a beer. And so Pat loved to say in that, about that story, I almost fell on my ass. Because, you know, he was going to...
He liked him so much, he got Pat to open his wallet.
Yeah, Pat O'Connor was going to buy me a beer. So, you know, that's Pat in a sense. You know, he was... You know, if people were unsure about him because he was gay, he would win them over from Vern Gagne to Ron Shire. He would, and especially Louis, you know, and Mad Dog also, he won Mad Dog over, you know. Louis was afraid of Mad Dog, and they ended up being almost better friends than Mad Dog and Pat were. So it's just how beautiful it is. And, you know, when you came from the outside and you don't know Pat until you actually, like, start working with him, he was so amazing, so friendly, so giving with me, you know. And then I'm not saying he was not difficult at times, but, you know, we would have like a, not a rough patch, but, you know, a little spat at the writing session and the interview session. And then by the time I get home, I had a message on my voicemail telling me how good I was and that he just went over the notes and that it was good. I was a good writer and we were going to get it done. And he would say, like, thank you, my friend, and don't give up, and we're going to do it. And so that's Pat, you know. Even if sometimes he would be difficult, he'd be very positive and very giving.
Yeah, and Bertrand, please accept from the entire team, which is Jeff, myself, and Sweet Lou, our condolences. You know, one thing that was very obvious when we were around you guys in Tampa was, you weren't just somebody that was writing a book with him. You were truly a good friend of his. And you two, you know, you could see it. You could really see in your interaction that you guys were really extremely close. So I want to touch on Louis a little bit. And you brought up Louis Dondero, who was Pat's partner of some 40 years. And years ago, I was, and I won't mention his name, but I was interviewing a now deceased professional wrestler. And he was, I don't want to say he was homophobic, but he was dropping slurs towards gay people a lot. However, when it came to Pat Patterson, he put Pat on a pedestal, and he would talk about going to dinner. I guess Louis was a great cook, everything I got. Mm-hmm. And he would talk about going to dinner over Pat's house and, you know, the house that Pat and Louis shared, and Louis would cook. But Louis seems like, as you mentioned with Mad Dog Vachon, Louis seems like he was also accepted by a lot of these guys that, you know, are, you know, as we consider macho and tough guys. But it seems like Louis was just kind of just taken right in. Would that be accurate?
Yeah. I mean, Louis would won people over right away, because the way Pat explained it was that Louis was very cultivated. He liked people. He had opinions about politics, opinions about history, about everything. So he would find conversation subject with everybody, and he was very fun person to speak with. So quickly he would impress people because how knowledgeable he was about things. And, you know, he, even more than Pat, because Pat had his things, and, you know, he was a little gruff around the edges sometimes, but Louis was just amazing. And he was an amazing cook. He came from an Italian family. His father was a great cook, and he just loved cooking. I remember the story. I mean, when they went to Minnesota, you know, Vern Gagne was like, when is Louis coming over to cook dinner? You know, Vern Gagne wanted to have a party because he had heard by Bockwinkel how amazing cook Louis was. So, you know, people who they met along the way would sing their praises before they came in any territory. So they would come in by the time, you know, we're talking about after San Francisco, and his reputation was stellar, and Louis's reputation was stellar as well. So from there, not that it was easy yet, you know, because you still have to hide and you still have not to, you know, it's fairly recent that you can, you know, just be gay without any stigma about it. So for them in the public eye like that, for Pat, it was always something. And that's what was important about for him as far as coming out at the end, even though everybody knew, like he said, I don't care. If everybody knew, I've never said it. Can I say it? You know,
right? Yeah.
The action of making that decision and actually verbalizing it himself was so important to him. I mean, I went from fighting with him over how to present Louis in the book as his boyfriend, because he said, "Well, he was not my boyfriend; he was my friend. I never called him that. Don't call him that." And then we went and did some interviews, and he was calling Louis his boyfriend. So.
Wow. Gotcha. Let me ask you a question. With Louis and Pat as a couple for 40 years, when Louis Dondero passed away, did Pat ever really get over that?
I don't think he ever got over Louis. You know, Louis was the love of his life. And, you know, like he said to me, I mean, if I was to find someone, wow, it would be amazing. But, you know, I'm not looking for anyone, or I'm not looking for anything that'd be serious. because it just, you know, it didn't seem to him that there was that second love out there for him. So it's just like, you know, for him, it was very hard when he was telling me the story, is that he went back to work as quickly as possible. And you know, early on, I mean, you know, you get into your day of work and, you know, you're busy, you go to the bar afterwards, take a drink, and then go to the room, which the what his routine was when he went back to the room, he would call Louis. So at first, he would go to the room and he would realize with the phone in his hand about to call Louis that, you know, there was nobody to call anymore. So that was very hard. It took a long, long time for him to feel okay about it.
So, Bertrand, if you don't mind me asking, I'm going to ask you to speculate on something. We had talked earlier about what the possible impact this would have on Vince McMahon, because Vince and Pat work together so closely. I have to assume that this has to impact Vince, who's not known, let's be honest, as a guy that's going to, you know, shed tears for just about anybody. But somebody like Pat, who was such a part of his life for so long, would you say this has to impact Vince on a certain level?
Oh, I mean, yeah, I'm sure it has an impact. You know, they were very close, and the tweet that Vince sent today was obviously, you know, not written by someone else, as it was very touching in the way that he saw Pat. And Pat sometimes felt bad because he said, I'm not doing anything. Why am I on the plane and why am I getting those privileges? And Vince would tell him, you know, if you wouldn't be there, it would not make sense. You know, you deserve to be there. You know, the company's success is your success. And you know, as long as I'm there, you belong here. And often, you know, when we were still writing the book around 2016, he was still going on at TV on a regular basis. And when he would miss a few weeks, you know, he didn't like to travel to the West Coast anymore because too long. Vince would tell him when he was back, I just feel better because you're there, you know? So that's the kind of relationship that they had. And often enough, I mean, I could see sometimes the difference, you know, when Pat was not at TV and when he was back in those days, I could see the difference. There was a clear vibe missing in some of the stuff while he was still very involved as far as giving his opinion on how things should proceed for the evening. So, I mean, it is a big, big, big blow for the McMahon family. He was that uncle, that brother almost to Vince. That's for sure. And even though, you know, Pat, you know, didn't want to work for all of his life and he wanted to be able to retire and not have to go work every week, they were very, very close. And he loved the family. And, you know, he was a consultant until the end. And I'm assuming that they're going to take good care of his memory and that we're going to get special packages in the coming shows and hopefully, you know, something special at the Royal Rumble. Because, I mean, apparently, I mean, the Royal Rumble of 2020 was the last show he attended.
We were talking before we started recording. Actually, in another segment in the show, Barry and I were talking about how as we lose these gentlemen that were giants of our youth, you know, men like Patterson, and, you know, Rocky Johnson, who we lost earlier this year, and how it impacts men that are, you know, my age or not just men, fans that are my age or Barry's age, and the impact it has on us. And, you know, maybe it doesn't impact people of a generation before or after us. And then, you know, we started talking and we said, well, geez, think about it. What sort of impact did a guy like Pat Patterson have on a career of a Shawn Michaels or a Bret Hart? Who I'm sure, and you know, at a TV production, they were getting impact from Pat because Pat was known as a guy that was so intelligent and smart to the business, a guy that was a finish guy, a guy that could help you work out something that you weren't. And so obviously, these people that are younger than Barry and myself, that are fans of Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, whoever, they don't realize how Pat Patterson impacted their lives through the guys that he helped.
I mean, when you start doing the list, I mean, it's goosebump. I mean, it's like Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, Chris Jericho, Edge, The Rock, Daniel Bryan, Rey Mysterio. I mean, their career, their push, their ascension into a major role, I mean, can all be credited to Pat, you know, going to bat for them and pushing the idea on Vince. And because he knew those guys had the thing that the fans wanted, you know, that the fans wanted to see. So it's mind-blowing, you know, all those guys that he had a major impact in turning into the superstar they were to become. They called him the Yoda. And I think it's so fitting for any Star Wars fans if you, you know, make the comparison of Yoda with Pat Patterson. Everybody gets it, what he meant to those guys. And especially the generation of the Edge, Jericho, Christian, of the Attitude Era. I mean, Pat was their agent. And one of the things I loved is that Pat was old school. Don't get me wrong. But, you know, if you had an idea, he would listen. He would maybe tell you it was bullshit, but he would listen to the idea and he would maybe take your idea and do something better with it. You know, that's what the guys love, because the real star in this business, they always have idea. They always come up with their own stuff and their own idea, and they want to push and they do want to do this. But as Pat likes to say, everybody needs to be produced, you know. Even Michael Jackson needs a producer, he would say. So it's like that tweaks and that try this and have you think about that. That's where Pat was so amazing and where the talent found someone who had no ego about ideas. You know, you just wanted to get the best idea out there. You know, they said, you know, some agents were like, you know, it was already no before they even finished their idea. Pat would listen and then he would like help them come up with something better if that didn't work, or, you know, he would say, you know, he would then go to bat for their own idea. So it's something that a lot of talent, and I'm sure even if you try to make a list, you're forgetting important people who had a major impact on wrestling that Pat had a major hand in putting out there in the front line and in the main event.
Yeah, and we talked about it too earlier in the show, but I don't feel that the WWF, when it came time to expansion, would have been as successful if Pat Patterson hadn't been a part of the company. I think from a knowledge and ideas and understanding what actually works in wrestling and what doesn't work. But with that, having Pat with us in Florida, and Jeff was there, you know, and you were there, Bertrand, and having Pat and Jerry Briscoe. And I did reach out to Jerry Briscoe today, and, you know, he came forth with a response that it's really tough to lose your best friend. And he's broken up and devastated about this. Had Pat been ill for very long, were you aware that Pat had been this ill?
I mean, it's fairly recent that the blood clot in his liver started to be an issue and was discovered. It's even more recent. So he went in the hospital on the November 27th.
Oh, wow.
And passed away. So that blood clot in the liver led to a liver failure. And there was other issues they were discovering as they made tests, but since the liver was not going to be, they were not going to be able to do anything to save him with the liver, there was no point in exploring the other issues. And, you know, it went very, very fast, you know, a couple of days, November 27 to December 2nd, that's like 5 days. Pat had been fighting dementia and Alzheimer's in the past few years. He had good medication that kind of stabilized him along the way. But, you know, especially spending the whole year almost alone in Florida, that was not good for his spirit and morale, that's for sure. But except for that, and that's one thing I would like to tell now is that, you know, if anyone in the business met Pat in the past few years and thought Pat was big leaguing them and didn't recognize them or anything like that, I can assure you that I would do my best always to make sure to get Pat to remember. And that sometimes he just simply didn't remember. And it was not because he was trying to be above them or anything like that. He was very courageous in the past few years, considering what he was battling at the time.
Well, listen, Bertrand, we want to say that we certainly appreciate you joining us and giving your thoughts and your recollections on on your friend, Pat Patterson, as I said, a true legend on behalf of Barry and myself, at least fondly remember our time with Pat at the CWF Legends event. And we fondly also remember, and we've talked about it in an earlier part of this podcast, our experiences with the lovely ladies of the International yeah. Beer Gardens, who I think they're still looking for your credit card, Bertrand.
Yeah, they will look forever.
So anyway,
that's such an amazing story, but I love it. After complaining on the way there that it was too far, that Pat ended up doing a live free Q&A in the lobby before the convention.
And we talked about that also. So as we are wont to do on this show, Bertrand, we raise an adult beverage to the memory of your friend, Pat Patterson, and a guy that we certainly will miss for what he meant to the wrestling business. And we say salute to you, Pat Patterson. Thank you for joining us, Bertrand.
Thank you.
Barry, always a pleasure to talk to friend of the show, Bertrand Hebert. Again, he will always be a part of our lives, if not for the book about Pat Patterson, the International Beer Garden story.
Yeah, absolutely, too. And I'll tell you, those guys in Canada, Bertrand and Pat LaPrade, that we had on, you know, a few months ago talking about, I think it was over the murder of Dino Bravo, if I'm correct.
Correct, yes.
And that was right around the same time that the Andre book was coming out, which was a collaboration between Pat and Bertrand. They're just doing exceptional, exceptional work. I think these are two of the finest professional wrestling authors out there currently.
Yeah, there's no question about that. So, and if one thing we know here on the old Breaking Kayfabe, it's a good wrestling writer. I think you'll agree with me on that, Barry. So now at this point, folks, it's about time to do the old go home. And I know Sweet Lou loves it when I don't forget the bumper to say that we are a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. So on behalf of my co-host, Mr. Barry Rose, and our producer, the sweet man, they call him Lou Kippelman. We will talk to you next week, folks. Thank you so much for joining us. Salute to Mr. Patterson.